This is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to start up with an article about Joni Mitchell's new Archives Volume 4, The Asylum Years, 1976 to 1980, and then a short interview with the Strokes lead singer, Julian Casablancas, and then an article about the Ramones, and a classic album review of Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere by Neil Young. Okay, I'm going to start off with the article about Joni Mitchell that's titled Refuge of the Roads. Joni Mitchell's Archives, Volume 4, The Asylum Years, 1976 to 1980, captures a genius in perpetual motion, speeding ever further away from musical expectations. It's kind of like running away from home to join the circus, says Joni Mitchell from the stage of the Montreal Forum. It's December 4th, 1975. She's about to introduce the audience to a work in progress called Coyote. I think it's finished, but I don't know. Maybe there's a couple more chapters to go. And sounds slightly bemused, she's still entangled in the motley rock and roll carnival that is Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review. 3 weeks after she first joined the tour in New Haven, Connecticut, on November the 13th. Joni Mitchell Archives, Volume 4, The Asylum Years, 1976 to 1980, shows, though, that Mitchell was in constant transient during this phase of her life. This latest dive into her past, out October 4th, is arranged across 6 CDs, or a shorter 4-disc vinyl set comprising Mitchell's favorite selections, and spans the boldly experimental jazz-directed period that includes 1976's Horizon, 1977's Don Juan's Reckless Daughter, and 1979 Mingus, as well as 1980 live album Shadows and Light. As Mitchell sings on Horizon, Abrasive Black Crow, captured live in Fort Worth on May 16, 1976, I took a ferry to the highway, then I drove to a pontoon plane, I took a plane to a taxi, and a taxi to a train. Here's a little bit of that song by Joni Mitchell, Black Crow.
There's a crow flying, talking ragged tree to tree. He's black as the highway that's leading me. Now he's diving down to pick up on that black crow flying in a blue sky. I took a ferry to the highway, then I drove to a pontoon plane. I took a plane to a taxi and a taxi to a train. I've been traveling so.
If her perpetual motion was quite literal, the Rolling Thunder Review's cocaine-fueled caravan, the onward march of her own tours in 1976 and 1979, the solo driving jags that inspired Horizon's revelatory dissections of freedom and its complications, it also reflected her relentless creative process. When I got to Horizia, my writing hit another level, Mitchell tells the journalist Cameron Crowe in Volume 4's Sleeve Notes, describing it later as a creative growth spurt, comparable to the one triggered when she saw Leonard Cohen play Suzanne at 1967's Newport Folk Festival. Mitchell's move away from being a confessional singer-songwriter, or sin-eater, as she described it in 1979, accelerated with The Hiss of Summer Lawns, released just as she was falling in with Dylan's crew in November 1975. Her new trip would culminate in her writing the words for melodies supplied by the terminally ill Charles Mingus, keen to tell a story that was not her own. The urge for going that defined the Joni Mitchell's Archives, Volume 1, The Early Years, 1963 to 1967, in 2020, is just as acute in the 33-year-old star as it was in the 19-year-old folk singer. Everybody else was playing their hits, she gleefully tells Crowe in the sleeve notes as they discuss the Rolling Thunder review. I was playing new stuff. The tour's resident playwright, Sam Shepard, subject of the musky Sinuous Coyote, a song that grew along with his on-the-road relationship with Mitchell, described the effects of her performances in his tour log. Every single time, the place goes up in smoke like a brush fire. And here's a little bit of that song by Joni Mitchell, Coyote.
No regrets, Coyote. We just come from such different sets of circumstance. I'm up all night in the studios and you're up early on your ranch. You'll be brushing out a broodmare's tail while the sun is ascending, and I'll just be getting home with my real trivial. She's no comprehending. Just how close to the bone and the skin and the eyes and the lips you can get. And still feel so alone and still feel related. Like stations in some relay, you're not a hit and run driver, no, no. Racing away. You just picked up a hitcher. Prisoner of the white lines on the freeway. We saw a farmhouse burning down in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the...
That's apparent in the Rolling Thunder recordings gathered here, some harvested from the Bob Dylan archives, a hushed Jericho from the Niagara Falls show on November 15th, 1975, a powerful Don't Interrupt the Sorrow in Cambridge 5 days later, featuring Mick Ronson and T-Bone Burnett, a version of Woman of Heart and Mind recorded at Gordon Lightfoot's Toronto House. Unabashed eavesdroppers, meanwhile, will enjoy the backstage snippet where Mitchell runs through Blues, A Case of You, all the time telling her companions about the troubles of miking up a dulcimer. It's made to be played by a babbling brook and her love of Canada Dry. Oh, Canada, dry, ginger ale. There's a fascinating real-time evolution here. On her own 1976 tour, she again plays Coyote, this time spliced to another new song. One of them was just coming to me as I passed through here in November, she tells the Boston crowd on February the 19th. The other one is a sequel called Don Juan's Reckless Daughter. While the tour ground to a premature halt, the stages had gotten too tall, the songs less intimate, she tells Crow in the sleeve notes. It left behind a fearsome version of the Jungle Line, a take on For Free that debunks the romantic version of that story, and Court and Sparks' jaunty Annie Ross song, Twisted. Are you crazy? She asks in the middle of it. That's the new norm. She's crazy enough to rejoin the Rolling Thunder Review when it hits Fort Worth on May 16, 1976, showcasing a beautiful song for Sharon. Yet Volume 4 also shows what happens when Mitchell's road songs settle in the studio, with demos from Horizia Sessions recorded by Henry Louis in March 1976. There are interlopers, Talk to Me, supposedly inspired by Bob Dylan's taciturn Mr. Mystery. Demeanor retains a blue-like swing before it falls under Jaco Pastorius's bass spell on Don Juan's Reckless Daughter. Dreamland has yet to shrug on its ancient cloak of percussion. Horizia exists in the tension between independence and surrender, freedom and comfort, desire for new ways of living, and the inexorable pull toward old ones. You can hear in these versions how she is slowly moving the lyrics of Amelia and Horizia around, jigsawing them into order as her thoughts shift. This Amelia opens with Take the Soap Out of the Wrapper, the song to a seagull callback of the Cactus Tree Motel. Not yet present, you sense this is a song that could keep reshuffling itself forever. Yet Mitchell still sought new chances for experimentation. When Charles Mingus approached her initially to rewrite T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, she saw it as a remarkable opportunity. The way I looked at it was, I put my toe in the water of jazz, Mitchell tells Crow in the sleeve notes. And now Mingus was going to drag me right into it, you know? And so I took the job for the experience. While the record was ultimately recorded with Mitchell's preferred musicians, Wayne Shorter, Jaco Pastorius, Herbie Hancock, there's also a chance to spy on the previous experimental sessions once believed lost. Here is a version of Sweet Sucker Dance with Jerry Mulligan on baritone sax. Eddie Gomez plays bass on Solo for Old Fat Girl's Soul, while there's a mellower alternate pass at God Must Be a Boogeyman, featuring Mitchell's ex, John Guerin, and guitarist John McLaughlin. A sense of what Mitchell's changing music meant to her in the world comes from a throwaway moment in a recording from September 1978. I've been working on a different kind of project for me, she says to the audience at Berkeley's Bread and Roses Festival. I've been writing words to Charlie Mingus's music. Then she launches into a gleeful caper through the dry cleaner from Des Moines. Rock and roll, Joni, shouts an excitable fan. That ain't rock and roll, man, calls back a clearly amused Mitchell. That's bebop. She keeps drawing those impulses together during the complete Shadows and Light era live set recorded at Forest Hills Tennis Stadium, Queens, on August 25, 1979. Her band, including Pastorius, saxophonist Michael Brecker, and guitarist Pat Metheny. In the sleeve notes, Mitchell tells a comic story about playing Dolly Parton, the newly finished Horizon. And when it was over, says Mitchell, she turned to me and said, "If I thought that deep, I'd scare myself to death." It's a delightfully double-edged response from Parton. But what is remarkable throughout this collection is how rarely Mitchell seems to strain or struggle instead of finding her own element, drives herself on. "No one's going to show you everything," as she sings on Horizon. But this collection shows a woman out to see as much as she can. And here's a little bit of that song by Joni Mitchell, Horizon. Okay, now I'm going to move on to an interview with the Strokes, the band The Strokes, lead singer Julian Casablancas. The Strokes / Void's main man talks entitlement, respect, and Arctic Monkeys. 3 a.m. Pacific Coast time is a typical hour to schedule an interview, but there's Julian Casablancas zooming from Los Angeles, where the singer, for so long simonious with the grit and glamour of New York City, has lived since 2020. He's a busy man, as well as fronting long-running garage rock classicist The Strokes, whose sixth album, The New Abnormal, won a Grammy in 2020. He's found a refuge of sorts in his experimental 80s synth-enabled group, The Voids, whose new LP, Like All Before You, is eminent. Talking to Mojo, Casablancas remains in shadow, his eyes occasionally reflecting dim light. "I can be a vampire," he promises. "You want a real rock star, bro? But I can be flexible and go into family mode, too." "What are you doing up at 3 a.m. talking to Mojo?" "It's about the only time I have free. The rest of the time, it's videos and working with managers, going to concerts, social things. So I go all the way around to crazy night hours." The new album starts with Overture and ends with Walk Off. Is there a concept lurking within? Well, I guess a little, maybe subconsciously. It hopefully hits if you have taken mushrooms. I had just watched Gone with the Wind, and they used to have overtures at the beginning of movies, and then we end the album with a synthesizer version. But it is not a rock opera story. If anything, the concept was going to be a one-word album title. At first, it was Zeal, then Perseverance. And here's a song from The Voids titled Perseverance 1C25. No How do you switch mindsets between voids and strokes songwriting? Voids songs are where my mind has been pushing me and where I want to go and where I am. But the ability or capability or muscle memory of writing strokes, sequel stuff, is just always going to be there. When those songs appear, it makes more sense to put them in each category, but it's not always that clear. But there's more, no limits with the voids. You recently said my current solution is to tour with the Strokes and then use the money to record with the voids. How did that happen? Years of drama and betrayals and horseshit. Honestly, I am cool with most of the dudes, and now we're more mature. It's not what I set out to do, but it's a fun, cool day job that I feel blessed to have. But let's just say I was only in a band called Zog, and whatever I worked on 10 years ago in Zog, I would not be interested in any more. I'm only interested in what I'm working on now. It's just the nature of music and creativity, you know? What did you set out to do with the Strokes? I just wanted to challenge boundaries and to have an ambitious collective of respectful teammates. Is that the voids? For me, yes. The cliche about the Strokes issues is that you were rich kids who weren't hungry enough. Any truth in that? Success affects people in different ways. I'd say there are some elements, probably from me as well, where you can be entitled. All kinds of bands have fallings, outs, and drama. It wasn't like, oh, we don't need the money. I think it did take a lot of hunger to get there. But then, after you've achieved something, when everyone is kissing each individual member's ass, okay, let's get back to work and do it again. It was like, no thanks. That's my assessment. The Arctic Monkeys song, Star Testament, starts out, I just wanted to be one of the Strokes. What was your reaction? I thought, be careful what you wish for. It was funny and flattering. I have a lot of respect for Alex and those boys. Tell us something you've never told an interviewer before. I've been trying to communicate with crows lately. I heard they have an intricate sonic language, but I haven't had any luck. It occurred to me that food would help, so I was trying to feed one M&M's earlier, but he wasn't having it. People can catch me making weird noises, trying to mimic the crow. I think the crows are more startled than the humans. Okay, now I'm moving on to an article about the Ramones, titled New York State of Mind. 50 years since their instigation and 10 since the passing of their last original member, the Ramones' rock and roll revolution maintains a living legacy. But was there ever a more unlikely success story? Chris Needs returns to the birth of the band, unraveling a tale of blood, toil, tears, sweat, more blood, heroin, OCD, dumb genius, and perfect timing. They ignited the power keg that was waiting to be ignited. July 4th, 1976, the Ramones have just made their UK live debut at the Roundhouse in North London. And blood gushes in the dressing room, post-set. That was horrible, spits Dee Dee Ramone, nursing his bass-strumming right hand, still wrapped in a handkerchief. He blames a hostile sound crew, unaccustomed to high-velocity punk rock, and more at home with retro headliners, the Flaming Groovies. While punk rock in the UK is already underway, the Ramones are here to reinforce its still alien template. Stripped down, speeded up, insanely catching and devoid of frills, amping up their recently rehearsed debut album with matching visual impact. Reactions at a soirée in the Stars and Stripes festooned Roundhouse Bar veer between ecstatic, dumbfounded, and aggressively dismissive, although a small cadre of punks laying into the free booze sense their revolution getting closer. The Sex Pistols are away playing a Sheffield pub. The Clash, making their live debut, are supporting them. But both bands are in London and following night for the same lineup at Dingwalls. Tangibly more at home in a room of similar size to their Manhattan home base CBGB. The Ramones coalesce into one blistering warhead, decimating the packed club with 17 songs in around 35 minutes. Johnny Mean and Spread Eagled, Stick Thin Joey slithering around the mic stand like a praying mantis, Dee Dee bellowing 1, 2, 3, 4 between each onslaught, and Tommy driving everything with cool precision on the drums. After their set with The Shadows of Night's 1966 garage rock classic, Oh Yeah, booming over the sound system, the Ramones gather around a low brick wall in the courtyard for an interview. With your writer, Tommy, self-described spokesman and business guy, perches on my right, smiling benignly before me, looms 6'6" Joey Ramone, who will utter one sentence. Amiably goofy, Dee Dee chats with fans. To my left, here's Johnny, his eyes piercing blue orbs as he praises John Denver and extreme horror films before doing most of the talking. Guitar solos slow us up and bog us down, he says. The chords are doing everything. I'm driving away where the guitar breaks would be, so the songs end up being short. If we stopped and talked to the audience, that would add another 10 minutes to the set. We really feel what we are doing should be done in half an hour. If this is a radical position in mid-1976, it would have been close to unimaginable in mid-1974, when the Ramones played their first shows at a courtier of freaks on Manhattan's Lower East Side. 50 years since the group's instigation and 10 years since the death of Tommy, the last standing original member, the band still seem to occupy their own universe. One where four desperate, even dysfunctional characters, their cartoon appearances belying the real world trauma of drugs, alcohol, jail, mental institutions, and crippling medical conditions could change the world. Donnie Fields, the U.S. record industry insider who'd befriended the Doors and championed the Stooges and managed the Ramones between 1975 and 1980, was at those London shows. Today, he encapsulates their impact. The Ramones ignited the power keg that was waiting to be ignited. Born in Budapest to parents who'd escaped the Holocaust, Tommy Ardonai was the only Ramone whose upbringing could be considered remotely normal, landing among his future bandmates in suburban Queens, New York. After his family fled 1956's Hungarian Revolution, at Forest Hills High School, he fell in with fellow guitarist John Cummings, son of an Irish-descended construction worker and strict disciplinarian, who had attended Peekskill Military Academy. In 1966, the pair formed high school garage psych band The Tangerine Puppets, before Indra Nai relocated to Manhattan and studied studio engineering at the record plant, forming a band called Butch, after witnessing the New York Dolls at the Mercy Arts Center in 1972. The other three future Ramones enmeshed when Cummings befriended Michael Hyman, a.k.a. Mickey Lay, because he played guitar and shared a love of the Stooges, a hardline conservative who hated hippies. Cummings had no time for his new friend's unusually tall brother, Jeff. In 1969, aged 18, Jeff followed the Aquarian Trail to San Francisco, where he was robbed of all his money and returned with a serious foot infection. John always ignored my brother, Lay told me. He saw him as the hippie freak, space cadet, but knew about the OCD that ruled his life. Joey was already very shy, inhibited, and easy to dominate. Later, John liked to keep him that way. Branded a freak at school, music provided Jeff Hyman's escape and obsession. The Beatles, Beach Boys, Herman Hermits, and Phil Spector's Wall of Sound. Thrown out of home in 1972 after an OCD-related flare-up, resulted in him threatening his mother with a knife, and ended with a spell in a psychiatric hospital. Hyman gravitated to downtown Manhattan's glam scene, now calling himself Jeff Starship, and sporting platform boots with a 6-inch heel. He joined Queens-based glitter band Sniper. They supported Suicide twice at New York's Talent Recon Inc. Theater in 1973. Subsequently, the headliner's frontman, Alan Vega, remembered this tall, skinny creature with black gloves and glasses who looked like he was on another planet from the rest of the band. Hanging out at Queen's night spot, the Coventry, Jeff met Doug Colvin, who had grown up on German army bases where his army dad, an alcoholic, was posted. Settling in Forest Hills with his mother after his parents divorced, Colvin had embraced delinquency and drugs, including heroin, and served jail time for armed robbery and car theft. In New York, he financed his addiction, turning tricks on the corner of East 53rd Street and 3rd Avenue. Mickey Lay drove past Colvin there, remembering the black leather jacket he would later wear on the Ramones' debut album cover. While working as an office building's mail clerk, Colvin renewed his acquaintance with John Cummings, working construction nearby. Meeting every lunchtime, the pair decided to buy guitars and start a band. Hitting Manny's music store, Cummings bought a blue Monstrite for $50. Colvin's a Dane Electro. They asked Jeff Starship to play drums and tried then-fired bassist Richie Stern, switching to bass and handling vocals. Doug renamed himself D.D. Ramone after the Paul Ramone pseudonym Paul McCartney deployed, signing into hotels. Jeff Starship became Joey Ramone, Cummings' Johnny Ramone. The band's existence was a victory over Forest Hills' normality. I didn't fit in anywhere, Joey told Hit Parader. I was an outcast. That's how the Ramones came to be. We were all outcast. By 1973, Tommy Erdeli was co-running the Performance Studios on 23rd Street with future Ramones tour manager Monty Melnick. Having stayed in touch with his Forest Hills homeboys, He became the new band's manager, producer, and advisor, letting them rehearse at the tiny venue and crystallizing their mission to produce what he called hit singles mixed with hard rock. The new band unveiled itself at a Performance Studios showcase on March 30th, 1974, before around 30 invited friends, playing a set that already included I Don't Want to Go Down to the Basement, I Don't Want to Walk Around with You, Now I Want to Sniff Some Glue, and Joey's never recorded Suck You Bus. Here's a little bit of the Ramones song, I Don't Want to Walk Around with You. According to Melnick, Dee Dee was having a hard time singing and playing. Tommy had heard Joey sing, so moved him to the front to do the lead singer. Singing. Joey immediately stood out with his unique look and the way he approached the songs. It clicked right away. Now they needed a drummer, but we couldn't find one who had the right sound, Tommy told me. Drummers would come down, and I would have to show them what to play. In the end, I said, fuck it, I'll play the drums. Ramone's songs allied 50s and 60s rock and roll discipline to lyrics that mainlined their lives. Dee Dee's 53rd and 3rd referenced a street pickup gone fatally wrong. Glad to See You Go celebrated splitting with a psychotic girlfriend. Joey matched two-chord drones to lyrics that really dealt with my feelings and things I could relate to myself, before Johnny beefed them up. Along with his beloved Peter Noonan, Joey took inspiration from the Bay City Rollers, Shag-A-Lang Pop. Saturday night's Terrace Stomp sparked the subsequently defining Blitzkrieg bop. The leather jackets and jeans look came from New York near contemporaries, the Dictators. And here's a little bit of that famous Ramones song, Blitzkrieg Bop. Low-key Performance Studios showcases continued while the Ramones sought their own cavern or crawdaddy where they could hone their sound and build a crowd. They found it at a rundown biker bar that had opened on the Bowery the previous December with a show by fearless pioneer Jane County. There really was no place to play except Max's, Kansas City, and Mother's, she says, citing the established underground clubs located at Union Square and Chelsea, respectively. At that time, New York City was a cesspool of crime, degeneracy, trash-filled streets, and raw rock and roll. But everyone needed a cool rehearsal dump to play and work out the kinks in their music and image. County had found precisely that dump. Dee Dee was sitting in a booth with me, complaining that the Ramones needed a place to play, so I told them about CBGB. In 1969, former Village Vanguard jazz promoter Hilly Kristal had taken over the Palace Bar at 315 Bowery, adjoining the Palace Hotel Flophouse, naming it Hilly's on the Bowery in 1972, failing to replace the rectangle clientele, he changed the name to CBGB, Country, Bluegrass, and Blues, appended by OMFUG, other music for uplifting gormanizers. Locals, including Suicide, appeared before Art Rockers Television's April residency put it on the map and brought in Patti Smith, then reciting her poetry over Lenny Kaye's guitar. It would prove a magnet for musicians and artists drawn to the burnt-out Lower East Side and East Village by cheap rents and low-intensity policing. We used to feel we were putting our lives at risk just by hanging out down there, recalls Walter Luhr of Johnny Thunder's Heartbreakers. That gave the scene the edge that made it exciting. In 1974, before a wider world knew CBGB existed, the place was more like Crystal's front room, with bookcase containing arcane torms and military manuals, the walls adorned with 1920s horse racing murals, and blow-up old photos of vaudeville stars, a makeshift stage carpeted in red shag pile. Blondie's Chris Stein remembers it as just like going into somebody's crummy basement. There were big, stuffed easy chairs, and Hilly had these dogs that would crap all around. It was all very funky. CBGB also served as a social club for local residents, forming bands including Blondie. Stein and Deborah Harry resided two blocks south on Bowery. Talking Heads on Christie Street, Lenny Kaye across the road. Dee Dee and Joey often stayed at Mexican artist friends Arturo Vega's loft around the corner on East 2nd Street, on the block now named Joey Ramone Place. The band made their CBGB debut on August 16, 1974, along with an early Blondie incarnation, Angel and the Snake. Although their 15-minute set fell apart when they started fighting about which song they were playing, prompting Kristal to describe them as the most untogether band he had seen, the CBGB proprietor booked 24 further appearances before the end of the year. Hilly said, "Nobody's going to like you guys, so I'll have you back," recalls Joey. The Ramones were still totally awesome, even in their very raw state, says Chris Stein. We immediately became diehard fans. They would do these very precise, super short songs that might have been constructed as parodies. if the songs themselves hadn't been so great. They sometimes stopped in the midst of a song and discussed and argued some aspect of it. But pretty soon, they were playing all the way through their songs. By 1975, a much tighter Ramones had become the scene's figurehead group. Talking Heads made their CBGB debut, supporting them in June. They were jaw-dropping, says their drummer Chris Frantz. Blondie, arriving at their first solid lineup, opened for the Ramones on July the 4th. Alan Vega remembered, "The best thing I'd seen since the Stooges." The intensity was astonishing. The Cramps, newly arrived in New York, were also smitten. "The Ramones are what set our pants on fire," recalled guitarist Poison Ivy Rorschach. "We took guitarist Brian Gregory to see them when we first formed the band. He was so overwhelmed with excitement that he actually had to throw up." In late 1974, Tommy produced a 15-track demo that initially failed to impress record companies. But after catching the Ramones at CBGB, Sire Records' A&R scout Craig Leon spent most of the year trying to convince his boss, Seymour Stein, to sign them. The whole Ramones thing was very much like a conceptual art piece. "Who decided they were a band," says Leon. "But it was Tommy's thing, and he kind of dictated what everybody did." Later, Tommy would admit that the Ramones, in their rawest state, were not for everyone. "The first time a lot of people see us, they're sort of mystified," he said. "They don't know what's going on. If you're not used to the songs and you haven't heard them before, they really sound from outer space. People don't know how to react." And this is where I'm going to stop, but I will continue this article next week. So we have enough time for the classic album review, which this week is Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere by Neil Young. Neil Young, Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere, 1969. First electric album with Crazy Horse blueprinted the guitar-driven sound that would later inspire grunge. Neil Young was in search of something new. Freed from the burning intensity of Buffalo Springfield, he had signed to Reprise as a solo artist and issued a lavishly arranged, predominantly acoustic album which gained solid reviews, but sold poorly. His voice had been buried in the mix, which briefly caused him to disown the album. Now he was determined to start afresh. His new direction owned much to a debilitating bout of flu, which had rendered him helpless, but simultaneously unleashed his imagination. High with fever, he'd written three songs, Cinnamon Girl, Cowgirl in the Sand, and Down by the River. And here's some of the songs, Cinnamon Girl by Neil Young. The lyrics were understandably vague and dreamy, and the chords simple yet arresting. In his mind, Young began to hear a hypnotic beat that cried for electric instrumentation. He could have assembled a crack team of LA session players, but instead he chose a bar band that he knew from the Springfield days. The Rockets had made one album for White Whale, but weren't exactly setting Hollywood alight. He took the rhythm section, which was me, Billy Talbot, and Danny Witten, drummer Ralph Molina recalls. It evolved into Crazy Horse. We hadn't played many shows as the Rockets anyway. Crazy Horse was one of Young's most inspired moves. They provided him with the same excitement he remembered from the heyday of Buffalo Springfield. And here's a little bit of the song Cowgirl in the Sand from the same album from Neil Young. Crazy Horse was one of Young's most inspired moves. They provided him with the same excitement he remembered from the heyday of Buffalo Springfield, a bet without the mind games and rivalry that characterized his dealings with the fiery Stephen Stills. Although the partnership would drift at various points in his career, Young would always return to Crazy Horse in search of renewal. This album proved one of the best electric guitar albums of its era and established Young's reputation as a player of great passion and unrestrained intensity. And here's a little bit of the song Down by the River from Neil Young off of the same album. Everybody knows this is nowhere.
Side, oh, be on your side.
hard for me staying here all alone, when you could be taking me for a ride. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She could drag me over the rainbow, send me away.
I still think that us being with Neil was fate, Molina concludes. We were just four guys. That crazy horse sound came from all four of us. Neil wouldn't have found that sound with anybody else. That was the way we played, with raw emotion. Fortunately, once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the November 2024 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off, I'm going to finish the article about the Ramones that I started today. And then there's an article about Randy Newman and a book review about the Greenwich Village music scene and a classic album review of Rio by Duran Duran. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long. And keep rockin'.